The next topic relates to the use of bevacizumab with chemotherapy as first-line treatment for metastatic disease. Bev plus paclitaxel, as utilized in the ECOG 2100 trial, is utilized by most of the faculty as first-line therapy, and 6 faculty members would use it second-line in a patient progressing on capecitabine. Dr. Pegram began the discussion.
I was impressed by the E2100 data, and in particular, if you look at the hazard ratio, it's very much reminiscent of our experience in the pivotal trial of Herceptin in the first-line HER2-positive metastatic setting. Moreover, if you look at the one-year survival outcome differences, they also fall right on top of the one-year survival differences that were seen early on in the Herceptin pivotal trial. So clearly there's demonstration of efficacy in terms of improved time to tumor progression. The overall survival data are not yet mature for that data set, but they should be this year, I would expect. The last time Kathy Miller updated that data set, I think only about 30% of the final number of survival events had yet occurred, and so we'll have to wait for the final analysis on that.
What about this issue of first and second line therapy? Again, this situation where the patient's gotten capecitabine, so now technically they're second line. Does that change?
That's being addressed in the ongoing Ribbon 2 study, which is exactly this situation, and patients are on that study allowed to receive a menu of different chemotherapy options at the investigator's discretion and then randomized to bevacizumab or not in the second-line setting. Short of any data from such a trial, I probably would not routinely recommend it in the second line myself because there's literally no data to support it in the second line in metastatic breast cancer at this time.
Ryan, what's your thoughts on this?
I'm extremely impressed. I mean, you've got a drug here which, going beyond the breast world, has shown efficacy in colon, lung, various other sites. I think this whole field of anti-angiogenesis, I mean, my first contact with Judah Folkman was when I was with NCI. He came to present in 81, 83. I mean, this is a field which I think is going to change, and I could see in routine practice in 4 or 5 years alternating bevacizumab with sinitinib, with sorafenib, and a whole range of antiangiogenics. In terms of continuation of therapy or activity in second line, Mark is absolutely right, of course. There is no data in this. But I do have the feeling that we're going to be seeing significant activity in second and third line metastatic disease. I think we will see some of that.
Kathy, what are your thoughts?
Well, not using it, aren't funded for it, but I think this drug is going to be active and that we will be using it in a broader setting. I think we're just waiting for a little more data.
One of the first reactions to this was, quote, well, we have so many agents to treat breast cancer. What's the big deal? You want to comment on that?
We don't have enough of the right agents to treat breast cancer or women wouldn't be dying of it.
Ron?
One of the things that changed my view of the data was the update when they showed us the subgroups. And before, it was kind of taxane previously untreated. And I said, who do I come back to with a taxane after adjuvant taxane? And it seemed like the data is really not very good in that setting. But then when they showed us the subgroup who had adjuvant taxane, the hazard ratio was almost identical. So that suggested it really probably is the best data for first-line previous taxane-exposed patients. So it's really a wonderful slot for it, in my view.
Eric?
As I said, I really don't think you can think of this as another combination therapy like, you know, a taxane and capecitabine or gemcitabine. It's important to recognize that there was a previous largely negative randomized trial with capecitabine. There was a hint of something going on there. And the question is, was it the setting? Was it capecitabine? Was it a chance difference? I think we should be careful about not being too rigid about defining first and second line because so much of this depends on what someone has received in an adjuvant setting. A woman who received TAC or AC followed by paclitaxel 9 months ago in the adjuvant setting and now has a relapse and technically is in the first line setting is actually a far more refractory patient than many who are in the second line setting who might not have received any adjuvant chemotherapy. So I just think we have to be a little careful about being as rigid as the FDA is, perhaps, about these definitions.
So specifically in that scenario, the patient who's gotten adjuvant AC and that has gotten capecitabine for metastatic disease, what's your next move going to be?
Well, this is someone who had adjuvant AC a long time ago, recently.
A couple years ago.
So in the woman who's had it a few years ago and has had capecitabine as her first regimen, I'm not unwilling to try paclitaxel and bevacizumab there, recognizing that the ECOG trial did limit the eligibility to patients who had not received any chemotherapy in the metastatic setting.
Does not unwilling mean that's what you usually
do? That's probably what I would do in that particular situation, yeah, choosing my words carefully.
Aman, what's your thought about this whole controversy?
I don't think there is much controversy. The data clearly demonstrated that inclusion of a biologic with paclitaxel substantially improved the response rate and also time to progression. Survival is too early, and I think this is a viable positive lead, and we need to discuss with every patient who meets that eligibility guidelines and even maybe a little broader. And the next generation of trials will answer a little more clear that whether even in second and third line setting, inclusion of bevacizumab will enhance the response rate in that setting or not.
Would you consider combination chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, specifically a taxane, capecitabine, and bevacizumab, let's say a patient with rapidly progressive visceral disease where you're really concerned about getting a response?
I personally would not, because the safety data is not there and we don't know what dose of each drug we should be using when you're combining with that. I think that is not appropriate to recommend outside the context of, if somebody wants to do a clinical trial, yes, but not outside the context of clinical trial.
Let's imagine, if you will, that the trial does not show an overall survival advantage. And I don't actually know that. Let's make that assumption. So essentially, this is another palliative drug for the treatment of metastatic breast cancer that has the potential to relieve symptoms but does not improve survival. So if that's the case, my view is I would not use it in an asymptomatic patient because there's no symptoms to palliate. I'm going to choose something simple and low toxicity. And I'll probably reserve it for patients who are heavily symptomatic with visceral crisis where response is critical, because otherwise they're not going to be with us. And it's a critical decision to come up with the right life-prolonging treatment, or let's say symptom-reducing treatment. So that's kind of my view on it. I mean, I think that if it improves survival, my view will change. For example, all these arguments about when you use trastuzumab were all predicated on the fact it improved overall survival, upfront chemo. But with this drug, there's a chance it's not producing overall survival, in which case my view on it is quite different. And I think we should view it differently.
I completely
and shouldn't
agree.
Be giving it
sure.
to everybody with small pulmonary, asymptomatic pulmonary nodules.
I'd like to make just three comments, if I may. One is just in support of this, Matthew, if you look at actually the Willett data in terms of the biopsy stuff that was done, in terms of reducing intratumoral pressure, I think 8 of them were positive, and 3 of them, in fact, were negative. There were not any effect. So this is a drug which is not for everyone. It will be individualized with time. The second more general point I would make is just to remember that the hazard ratio on Kathy Miller's trial in the triple negatives was 0.48. So this is a drug you do really have to think of in triple negative disease. And the last point is just that I love the E5103 design, which has the bevacizumab ending with a chemo in one of the arms and then continuing for a year in the other, because we won't go into that old trastuzumab dilemma of like, when do you stop?
Aman?
The point I wanted to make is that let's say that there is no survival advantage. Still, I think in metastatic disease, the idea is that we want to control the disease for as long as possible. So if you start with combination therapy with biologics and chemotherapy, and you control the disease in much higher number of patients for a much longer period of time, I think still it is a major achievement from the patient point of view. Even though it may not result in long-term survival, may not be affected.
But what does that mean? You know, if you control the disease, so everybody dies, let's just say theoretically, there's no improvement in overall survival. Let's say everyone magically dies at 2 years, right? So what have you really achieved? I mean, by spending all this money on this biologic and you didn't prolong anyone's life, you really have to question what you're doing. That's my
view.
Well,
it depends what its palliative effect is, Matthew.
Right. So if you don't have symptoms,
if you
like
made
this
everyone
patient,
feel
why would you
perfect
palliate it?
Until they drop dead,
that's the perfect
that would be
end.
Perfect.
Yeah, Mara?
I think we have a lot to learn with this drug, and I think that we're gaining experience now with it, and we have this one positive trial in breast cancer, but I think, as someone referred to previously, it works across a number of diseases. I think if you ask anyone how it works, no one's quite sure, and as we learn more about how it works and how to appropriately select patients, I think then we'll better know where and who we should use it in. But right now, I think stringent rules about what line of therapy don't really make a whole lot of sense in that instance. And I think toxicity is an issue and probably one that needs to be considered when using this drug.
What is your experience with toxicity? And I think this relates to your question, is if you can delay the progression without introducing a lot of toxicity, I would view that as a positive palliative maneuver.
The other point I want to make, and then I'll mention toxicity, is that in colorectal cancer, there is now a trial that suggests that bevacizumab adds to second-line chemotherapy. So breast cancer is obviously not colorectal cancer, but this is a drug that works in a number of diseases. And again, we don't exactly know how it's working. So to stick with just first-line when it works as a single agent in ovary cancer and second-line chemotherapy in colorectal cancer, I don't think that this is an agent that we can be rigid with at this time. We were lucky with trastuzumab because we had a marker, HER2 positive disease. We figured out it works better in 3+ positive patients. Hopefully we'll find something for bevacizumab that will help direct our treatment. There's definitely hypertension, and it can be very significant. About 20% require 2 drugs to control the blood pressure, but it is, I think, a controllable toxicity. But I think as oncologists, we have to learn a little bit about internal medicine. With the aromatase inhibitors, we've had to learn a little bit about bone metabolism and osteopenia and osteoporosis and bisphosphonates. And I think with bevacizumab, we have to know to monitor the hypertension and also have a few drugs that we feel comfortable using and introduce them earlier. I've also had a few patients have nephrotic range proteinuria, and I do watch the urine protein creatinine ratio, not every cycle, but every few months I do monitor it. I think because the dose is higher in breast cancer at 15 mg per kg every 3 weeks or 10 every other, the incidence of proteinuria may be higher than what our colorectal colleagues see.
I've got to ask you to just very briefly present the patient you told me about yesterday who was on the so-called negative Bev capecitabine trial. I thought that was fascinating.
Right. So I have a patient who developed liver metastases in 2001 and was randomized to the capecitabine with or without bevacizumab study that we, and she likes to laugh about calling it a negative trial because she's still on capecitabine and bevacizumab. And she had a PR in terms of the study, but I think she's really had a CR in the sense that she had small lesions in her liver that are PET negative, and she leads a very full life, but she does have significant hand-foot syndrome. She's had significant hypertension and nephrotic range proteinuria, changes in her lipid profile, and we've had to carefully manage her toxicity, and at times we've given her breaks. The proteinuria comes down very nicely when you stop the bevacizumab. We've reintroduced it, sometimes at lower dose. We've played with it, but this is 6 years. I only have one patient like this.
But I have a handful of patients who did exactly that with Xeloda alone.
Right, and you absolutely can't
say, right.
It's always hard to say, and that's always the argument that you can use, and that she just has a very sustained response to capecitabine, but she's really done very well.
I just thought it was fascinating in terms of chronic bevacizumab therapy and, you know, how you adjust it to her proteinuria, et cetera. I mean, I guess that's something we'd love to see happen. Mark, did you want to comment?
My understanding is that the FDA's consideration will not be contingent on overall survival as the primary endpoint of the trial is time to tumor progression. Moreover, their decision to defer a final decision on the data set, I think it had more to do with the monitoring density available in a cooperative group network as opposed to an industry-sponsored trial, which has the resources available to have much more intense monitoring follow-up of the data set.
So my understanding was they wanted to go back and look at the x-rays and imaging studies, et cetera, again.
But all that's all process. I mean, if it doesn't improve overall survival, we have a very different set of considerations to drugs that do.
And so
if
it doesn't, I want to get at this issue for a second. So apart from what the FDA does, if the drug improves survival, it becomes a much more compelling drug to use today in clinical practice. In the absence of an improvement in survival, it doesn't mean that it's not a good drug. It's a very promising drug. There's a very impressive hazard ratio for progression-free survival. But this point of what to do with the asymptomatic patient is not trivial in the absence of an improvement in survival. And in George Sledge's study that compared sequential single agent versus combination therapy, there was a quality of life study as part of that study. And as much as I'm not keen on these studies, I think there was a very important point there, which is that the women who had the greatest fall-off in quality of life were the women who were asymptomatic to begin with. And the point is, it's hard to improve upon asymptomatic, and we should all be careful about that. Of course, if we know someone is about to develop symptoms, then intervening and preventing those would be a useful approach from the standpoint of quality of life. But we often don't know that, and I think we really do have to be pretty careful.
So how do you approach the patient where, for whatever reason, they're either triple negative or they've run out of hormones, who happens to be asymptomatic in terms of your decision?
For the patient who has triple negative disease, oftentimes those are patients who have relatively aggressive breast cancer, who, even if they don't have symptoms, will shortly develop symptoms. Not true of everyone, and I think that this is really a case-by-case call. And yes, in that patient, I would be that much more inclined to use a therapy like bevacizumab, even without an overall survival improvement. And I want to be clear, I'm quite enthusiastic about the whole class of drugs and about bevacizumab in particular. But when it comes back to how do we use it in practice today, without a survival advantage, I'm not going to tell a woman to go mortgage her house to get it paid for if her insurance company won't pay for it, whereas I would tell someone to do that with Herceptin at the moment.
MJ, do you want to make a final comment?
Yeah, I was going to continue on with the survival theme. I mean, we all know there's about 12 trials in the entire English language literature where there is a survival advantage. So it's very hard to find after doing hundreds of trials. And many of those are confounded by A plus B compared to A rather than sequence. And we don't follow those results. I mean, we don't give Taxotere Zeloda because it showed a survival advantage. I don't use that doublet. I don't think Taxol Gemzar has become the standard of care in metastatic disease because it has survival advantage over Taxol. So we say these things because we, of course, know survival is important. But as a practical issue, I don't think we, in metastatic setting, make decisions other than the Herceptin example where there was 2/3 crossover and you couldn't catch up. Other than that example of HER2-positive subset, I think it's very important to palliate patients for as long as possible and delay their progression. So I'm disagreeing a little bit with...
But why are you disagreeing? Man. You said the word palliation.
Yes.
And palliation requires you to have a problem to palliate.
Yes, no,
so if you follow your patients carefully, and in this patient with small asymptomatic pulmonary nodules, I would not choose a taxane with the attendant toxicities with bevacizumab over carefully managed capecitabine.
Well, let me clarify. I'm not talking about...
Or nothing.
The trial was not nothing versus therapy. The trial was Taxol versus Taxol bevacizumab. So if you have a patient where you have decided to give Taxol to,
that's
which you have,
matter.
That was the trial. So if you have already decided to give Taxol, why not add a biologic therapy
now
with
it?
Now
I agree with you.
And that's the point.
But
why not add a biological therapy?
But that's how the trial was done, Matt.
And that's exactly how the trial was
done. The control
done.
Arm, the doctor had to decide that the chemo was right.
But what Neil wants to know is, what do you do in your clinical practice? And I'm just saying that with bevacizumab, I don't rush up front to use a taxane in a situation I wouldn't normally use it.
Which is fine. All I'm trying to say is, you came across as if you were saying you would not add bevacizumab to Taxol because it doesn't have survival advantage. And I'm saying if you have already decided to use Taxol, it makes a lot of sense to then, at that point, add bevacizumab where the data is, which is how the trial was done, and double the time to progression. And if you agree with that, then we are not disagreeing
at all.
But
for me, Taxol is not a great palliative drug for metastatic breast cancer. There's other drugs that are easy to use or oral or have less frequent dosing, have fewer side effects, less alopecia. And so I'm going to choose those drugs. Doxil, capecitabine, endocrine therapy, those kinds of things, before I get to taxane, because that's going back on real chemotherapy.
Sure.
And I'd only do that when the symptom burden means that that's the only way to improve the patient's lot in life.
Final comment
from
Brian.
So one last provocative question to the group. Take E5103, the current bevacizumab adjuvant trial. How many around this room anticipate that that trial will be negative?
Nobody's raising their hand. I don't know if that's because they have no idea.
We don't like the question.
Yeah.
We object.
Right, we'll try to rephrase that. What do you think the trial's going to show?
I think it'll be a positive trial.
So do I.
I don't.
Who said they didn't?
I just said I don't, to be provocative.
Joe?
You asked me to weigh in on the E2100 issue, and I think the key issue here is that even if no survival difference emerges from E2100, the key point, I think, is that when used in more advanced settings, you don't get the treatment effect that you get when you use it either upfront or close to upfront. So I think ribbon 2 will be very important in terms of defining whether you get a treatment effect close to upfront that you would upfront. So I think nothing else comes close. I think the analogy to Herceptin that Mark brought up earlier is very appropriate because it's a targeted agent where actually we can't hone in on the target as precisely as we can in HER2-positive disease. And as a matter of fact, by excluding the HER2-positive patients, we're excluding the population that scientifically we would expect to have the greatest benefit from targeting angiogenesis. But nevertheless, the fact is that there's a striking treatment effect when used as first-line therapy. It's comparable to Herceptin in HER2-positive patients, at least with regard to response and time to progression. And when you delay the use of the drug, at least to the more heavily pretreated population, you don't seem to have any effect at all. So if you're going to use this drug, I think it's critical to use it as early as possible in the patient's course.
So just to follow up practically, again, patient has adjuvant AC, develops metastatic disease, not symptomatic, goes to see Matt. Matt puts her on capecitabine. She now has symptoms from her metastatic disease and comes to see you.
I would absolutely offer that patient paclitaxel and bevacizumab.
Yeah, so would I, probably.
Yes, would I.
The next topic was choice of taxane therapy in metastatic disease, and particularly the emerging role of nab-paclitaxel and new data presented at San Antonio suggesting that nab is associated with a higher response rate than Q3-week docetaxel. Most of the faculty considered nab-paclitaxel more efficacious and better tolerated than paclitaxel, and Dr. Mohammed Jahanseb began the discussion by commenting on the shorter infusion time required for nab.
From the practice standpoint, we have 6 offices, so in the smaller offices where it's crowding, chair time is an issue, so it's an advantage. And of course, patients don't want to sit there any longer than they have to, and not having to give pre-medications is an advantage, and lack of allergic reactions and shorter duration of neuropathy are all desirable. The incidence of neuropathy was higher in the Gradishar metastatic high-dose study, not in the weekly arm here. But I've now come to realize that with paclitaxel, weekly delivery is the way to go, or I should say of all the controversies in taxane scheduling and choice of taxane, the most clear single fact that has emerged is that 175 Q3 weeks of paclitaxel is clearly the most inferior regimen of all that we use and has been defeated multiple times in multiple settings. So I think that the way to go might be weekly with this drug, and cost is the only remaining issue with this drug in terms of from a practitioner standpoint, and that has been the reason I think of slower uptake. Otherwise, I think it's a very good advance in terms of making a very widely used drug better in terms of its efficacy and toxicity.
If the cost of NAB were the exact same cost reimbursement as paclitaxel, tell me if you agree with this statement. I would not use paclitaxel. I'd be using nab-paclitaxel. So I think everybody except Eric.
So show me the phase 3 trial that has compared this agent with weekly paclitaxel.
No, that has not been done.
I realize that.
Yeah. I never said that has been done.
And show me the phase 3 trial compared to paclitaxel that's been done in, and I don't mean to dismiss studies done entirely outside of the U.S., but I will, and practice patterns are a little different in some other places. The one phase 3 trial that was done was conducted predominantly in the republics that made up the former Soviet Union.
Yes.
So are you concerned that the efficacy might be less weekly of NAB versus weekly Taxol? Or that it'll be equal?
To begin with, I think this claim that the neuropathy is of shorter duration is based on a very small number of patients, and I'm not aware of any symptom complex that is typically more severe but goes away more quickly with one drug versus another. I think it's a very unusual
claim. But can I respond by saying 2 indisputable things about paclitaxel that we know, the Cremophore-based, that weekly paclitaxel is more neurotoxic than Q3-week.
I agree.
That's very clear. Okay. And numbers are not low. They range from 18 to 23%, depending on which study and which dose, 80, 90, or 100. So that's not a trivial issue, number one. And none of the experience so far, we have seen numbers even close to that with weekly nab-paclitaxel.
So if you want to give this every 3 weeks instead of weekly paclitaxel, I think that's reasonable.
Okay. So, I mean, I wasn't making any claim that hasn't been tested. What I mean to say is if we believe that this is paclitaxel and that's paclitaxel, they're both same drug, then I wouldn't put it to the same rigor as we have some other drugs in the discussion that are Agreed. Different drugs being compared to each other.
I think that's the point that yeah. comes back again, Eric.
Agreed.
Also, from a quality of life point of view, Eric, because that's always been one of the things that you have a lot of great insights on, how much, assuming everything else is the same, how much of an advantage practically do you think the infusion time and lack of premedications is? Is that really significant or not?
If you're talking about weekly versus weekly, weekly paclitaxel is administered over an hour. It's not a tremendously long period of time. And the need for ongoing steroid premedication when you're giving weekly paclitaxel is something that one can question. Maybe this will turn out to be a better drug. We'll have to see. But I think it's going to be important to investigate it just a bit further.
Yeah, I guess one of the things is I'm impressed with docetaxel 100 every 3 weeks hasn't been beaten by anything in metastatic disease setting. It's been tied by weekly paclitaxel. I know it's a phase two, but it really looks like substantial improvement in terms of the primary study endpoint, which was this kind of objective response. One can say, is that the right endpoint for trial? But there's been a lot of things that have been tried against, it seems like, against docetaxel 100 every 3 weeks in advanced and adjuvant setting. And so this, to me, is very impressive, especially since it looks like we're dealing with the same drug delivered in a slightly different fashion.
So let me just explain why I'm pushing you all, because it's actually conversations like this that prevent us from doing phase three trials that allow us to define whether a treatment is really better or not and worth maybe the extra dollars and maybe the trade-off in terms of what could
be more
neuro. So
you'd like to do a trial comparing weekly paclitaxel to weekly
Right, and there is such a trial that is proposed within the intergroup that has been approved by CTEP. And if everyone becomes convinced based on phase two data and the opinions of thought leaders that this is the better approach, then we'll never do that trial.
So what would the endpoint be in that study?
Well, the endpoint in that study is progression-free survival.
Yeah. But, you know, I would agree. I'm a big supporter of clinical trials. But again, to play devil's advocate and going back to Mark's point, we should quit doing these pedestrian studies and devote our time and energy on to asking real questions rather than Coke versus Pepsi studies, where the point that we'll prove at the end will be relatively modest.
I would turn around Mark's point and say that we shouldn't develop drugs that are essentially me too drugs, that we should stick with the drugs we have and focus our energy on developing drugs that will actually lead to a meaningful change in outcome for our patients.
Plus, this isn't Coke versus Pepsi, this is Coke versus Cherry Coke. Because they both have
I'm going to argue with you all about this because this is a drug that has a different delivery system. I have been very unimpressed with this. I've been kind of ignoring it in my, I kind of had this mental screen up. I think that even if there's a small but substantial difference that could be really nailed down, that that's important in practice. And I don't think that it's either or totally. I think what's bad is that a lot of companies develop these drugs and they do a sort of half-assed job of developing them. You know, they do a bit of it, but not enough of it. And then you've got drugs like this that are hanging around out in space forever, sort of used, pushed a bit, but not with enough data to push them across the line. And I agree with Eric that more investigation about this would be good. I don't think it's a waste of time. It may not be the most intellectually exciting thing, but it could be important for patients.
Mark, can you talk about your experience with dose-dense AC Abraxane?
Well, we have a feasibility study looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting, and it's using dose-dense AC Abraxane. And the trial is really just accruing at the present time. About 45 people are on, and really many aren't even through the Abraxane portion. So I can't add a whole lot about that. Hopefully we'll have a little bit more at ASCO.
I guess one thing that's been observed is the fact that your trial, I think, as well as Nick Robert's U.S. Oncology trial, did show that you need growth factors in that situation.
Right, so correct. When they did their pilot, it was a very small pilot, they didn't use Neulasta with the Abraxane, and they gave Abraxane 260 per meter every 2 weeks, and I think a third of patients couldn't get the Abraxane on time. And we've also done a study at Sloan Kettering, Steve Sugarman was the PI, where we tried to avoid the Neulasta with dose-dense treatment, and we could not get the treatment in on time. It required delays.
John, how much data are we going to need in order to consider using NAB in the adjuvant setting? Are we going to need a phase three adjuvant trial?
Well, first of all, I'm concerned about the metastatic data. I mean, Eric raised the fact it was done ex-US, ex-North America, but it was also a investigator-assessed response rate in an unblinded trial setting. So it's a recipe for disaster. And because of that, I think that we have to be careful of the metastatic data, particularly against docetaxel. And unfortunately, I think in the adjuvant setting, We, in particular, need randomized trials because, again, long-term toxicities are far more critical in a curative intent population. So I don't see a way around it, even though it's a boring trial. I hope someone else does it and tells me the results.
So I've been
I'm
feeling.
Not particularly interested in doing it myself.
Brian?
Again, to be provocative, but I really believe this, and I'd like to hear Matthew's and Mark's view on this. We're going to be increasingly facing targeted therapies based upon, in my opinion, biomarkers. To me, platinum, taxanes, anthracyclines at this moment are going to begin to be more biomarker-driven. There may be some with topo II with anthracycline. We don't know yet. It's controversial. I think the mismatch recombinant DNA repair business with the platinums, taxanes, the role of tau, other resistance markers, whatever. Surely it would be more important to determine if there is a basis for individualizing chemotherapy in 2007 as opposed to putting 2,000 or 3,000 patients on nab-paclitaxel versus paclitaxel.
I'm going to ask Joe final comment again in terms of practical decision making right now in your own practice. Where does NAB fit in?
It's not a drug that I've used a whole lot, mainly because I'm generally comfortable with administering weekly paclitaxel, usually in combination with bevacizumab. And I think the CLGB trial comparing the three taxane strategies will be successful because these are questions that are important to medical oncologists and to patients as well, because there are some different toxicity profiles of the agents. As a clinical researcher, I'd be much more interested in the trial if it had a 2x2 built in, evaluating a biological agent or not. But notwithstanding that, I think the trial will accrue, and I think it will address some important issues, not the most critical issues that I think we're facing, but I think it will provide some information.
So the trial is replete with all of the questions that you want to address, Brian. So I think that one can, in this case, have one's cake and eat it too. And in terms of the adjuvant setting, I think what the company heard from the FDA is that there needed to be data in the adjuvant setting, although given the fact that it is a drug that is essentially cherry paclitaxel, to use Mark's analogy, that they would accept a trial that was far smaller than the typical adjuvant trial, largely a trial to make sure that it isn't worse to a significant degree and that the toxicity is okay, that they would relax the p-value.
I was just going to ask the question of whether other people, maybe it's more usual in the U.S., and I think it's maybe driven by some other issues, but for me, the concept that we're bringing these patients in with metastatic disease for weekly therapy is, I didn't want to hear that weekly paclitaxel was better than Q3 weekly, because I see our patients coming in every week as becoming very tied to the cancer center, and that it really affects their quality of life in a way that I don't like and I don't think they like. Is anybody else got that sense, or?
Let's see a bunch of heads shaking around the table here. MJ, final comment. When you use NAB, are you using it weekly or Q3 week?
I've used both, but mostly I favor a weekly regimen because it's much better tolerated.
Aman?
One comment I wanted to make is there was another abstract, which was NSABP small study in a neoadjuvant setting with this nab-taxol. And in that study, the end result was PATCR, and patients who were HER2-new positive, the patients were allowed to use 24 weeks of trastuzumab, as we had done in MD Anderson study. And the result showed that patients who were HER2-new negative, PATCR rate was about 30%, and patients who were HER2-new positive, which was about 19 patients in that study, intent to treat analysis, there was 59% PATCR in the breast and in the lymph node. And the safety profile was looked at very critically in that, and this was a U.S. and Canadian study because it was done in NSABP. It was 12 doses of weekly paclitaxel, or 12 weeks, and most of the toxicities were grade 1 or 2.
But that was paclitaxel, right?
No, this was...
This is NAB?
NAB-taxel.
Interesting.
The data was presented by one of the Canadian...
Rabideau.
Rabideau, that's
Andre
it.
Andre Rabideau from Montreal.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes.